You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Cade Young. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024.
Later in the program, WFHB News spoke with Christina Avery and Haley Miller, two reporters from the Limestone Post magazine. Avery and Miller authored a two-part series on food insecurity. For Deep Dive, WFHB and Limestone Post investigate. More in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Eclipse Heads Up on Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment hosted and produced by Richard Fish. More following today's feature. But first, your local headlines.
At the MCCSC school board meeting on March 26th, conversations among the community and board members continued regarding the possibility of corporation-wide redistricting and the consolidation of Childs and Templeton elementary schools. School Board President April Hennessy stated that no one from the board was looking to complete this process for the 2024 school year.
So I think I just want to make that clear that the board has said pretty clearly that there is no action that will happen for 2024 regarding a consolidation or a merger of schools.
The board voted to continue discussing these topics at their next meeting, where members Aaron Cooperman, Brandon Schur, and Ross Grimes volunteered to present options for the merger and redistricting plans. The next meeting will be held on April 23rd at 6 p.m.
At the Richland Bean Blossom School Board meeting on Monday, March 25th, Assistant Superintendent Matt Irwin asked the board to approve rate changes to the K-5 before and after school care program, also known as the Latchkey program.
So this is to do some modest increases for our AM only. It would be $12 more a month for PM only services, $12 more a month. And if someone were to take advantage of the AM and PM services, it would be $15 more per month. So with that, it's just kind of a slight uptick in that pricing to help kind of ease some of the burden that we've continued to take on over the last 5 years. And we'll just put this on a yearly review like we do some of our other pieces so that we can do that. Two of the other things that we did put in there was that for families that qualify for assistance through free and reduced meals would also be allowed to have half rate. They pay half the rate. Then also for some families that have three or more children, their third or fourth child would be half the price as well. Just to continue to ease that burden on families. We know that we're providing this service to families that's very helpful to them. And so we want to continue to provide that and try to do it responsibly from a business standpoint as well. This is not something that we produce income off of. This is something that we provide purely as a service to the community. So with that, I'm asking for your approval to the adjustments for the rates for the 2024-2025 school year.
The board approved the rate adjustments, which will take effect at the start of the 2024-2025 school year. The next school board meeting will be held on April 15th at 6 p.m.
The Ellettsville Town Council met on March 25th and discussed amending the fire personnel policy to clarify the town's policy on the supervision of relatives. The amendment would clarify who is in charge of employees whose direct relative is their supervisor. Resident Jim Perry suggested that the town council amend the ordinance to outlaw or eliminate nepotism in the fire department outright. He quoted an article about the negative effects of nepotism in the workplace in his argument.
I think nepotism is unhealthy across the organization. You know, I'm looking at some of the language here, and let me know if I get to my 3 minutes, and I will. You know, one of the things that struck me in the language was, this is section 1C. It says, in the event the new member is a relative of the chief, the new member's departmental chain shall run to and end with next officer in the chain of command in the department who is not a relative and who shall not report to the chief for any matter relating to the new member. Now, the reason that that's problematic, as P Pierce summarizes in this article in Industrial and Organizational Psychology, nepotism places loyalty and obligations to one's family over obligations to one's employer. Nepotism is damaging because any claims that family members must take precedence over any organizational requirements.
Fire Chief Kevin Patton responded that nepotism doesn't pose a large issue in the fire service because the town council acts as a checks and balances system.
The way the fire service works, much like the police department, is anytime there's a promotion, things like that, it's a board of officers. It's not a single person. If it pertaining to discipline action or anything, same thing, the board of officers decide it, not just one. And then if it's over a certain level of discipline, it comes to the Board of Public Safety, which is the town council. So I don't see that any of those are a concern.
So we have the town council kind of as the check and balance.
Correct. And with raises, back to promotions, anything like that, there again, the council's the one that has the final say on the raises. It's not a fire chief or another ranking officer within the department.
The council voted to approve the amendment to the fire personnel policy as written. The next Ellettsville Town Council meeting will be held on Tuesday, April 9th.
In today's feature report, WFHB News spoke with Christina Avery and Haley Miller, two reporters from the Limestone Post magazine. Avery and Miller authored a two-part series on food insecurity for Deep Dive, WFHB and Limestone Post Investigate. The story has been placed in the Indiana Society of Professional Journalists Best in Journalism competition. For more about their process and what they learned from reporting on this issue, we turn to that interview on the WFHB Local News. Christina Avery, Haley Miller, two journalists who authored a two-part series on food insecurity for the Limestone Post magazine. For Deep Dive, WFHB and Limestone Post Investigate, welcome to the WFHB Local News.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So first off, just kind of a general question. What was the experience like reporting on hunger and food insecurity in Monroe County? And just kind of walk us through your process.
So I think, first of all, we just wanted to like get a really comprehensive look at everything. And so I think that started first with going to the state level.
We started out pretty broad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
But we also went and talked to people at community kitchens. Mm-hmm. And then this was later on, but we did sort of a grassroots thing where we would talk to people on Facebook groups were being open about their struggles, particularly like the Mutual Aid Monroe County Facebook group. So we found sources that way as well.
Mm-hmm. And we tried to narrow it down to seniors and other like marginalized communities, because we know that, you know, hunger affects a lot of people, but it really predominantly affects, you know, people who are underrepresented or not given certain resources within the community. And so that means, you know, seniors and children, especially, you know, people who were already in poverty across not only cities, but also like rural communities. So we wanted to kind of like go broad and then also narrow it down.
And those marginalized groups were also like particularly likely to be isolated mm-hmm. in their circumstances. So they didn't have those familial support networks mm-hmm. that a lot of times make the difference between being food insecure and maybe not being food insecure. So
yeah,
that was a big part.
And a lot of those communities also don't have access to like the same supermarkets we do here, like in Bloomington, for example. So like we have, you know, Walmart, we have Target, we have Aldi. But a lot of these places, like we learned, only have maybe like a Dollar General or a Dollar Tree or convenience stores and gas stations. And so that makes a really big difference, too, in terms of like quality of food.
Now, what did you learn about the prevalence of food insecurity in our community? Like, how widespread is this across different demographics?
I think it's something like 17 million households in the United States suffer from food insecurity. But in Bloomington, from 2022 or 2021, one in 10 residents actually struggled with food insecurity. So this is a very local and real problem in our community. And I think that was very striking to us, mm-hmm. particularly as students on Indiana University's campus. That's not always something that we're regularly exposed to. But really, finding out the statistics and then talking to individual people who were having those problems really reinforced for us just how big of a deal this issue is in our hometown, you know, or our home where we're living right now.
Yeah, totally. And it's also interesting, too, because being in Bloomington, you know, we don't, a lot of us don't experience that, you know, kind of in our day-to-day lives. But there are so many college students out there who are, you know, struggling with this and not being seen. And then there's also the issue within Bloomington. Everyone knows that we have, you know, kind of a large population of people experiencing homelessness. And so you might see those people and you might think of them as, you know, oh, they are experiencing food insecurity. And that's obvious and that's real. But there are also a lot of people who you might not think are experiencing food insecurity who are doing so, but you can't see that for whatever reason that may be. And that can be, you know, across any demographic, any community, like everyone is basically like one disaster away from that.
Yeah, that, I think that's the startling thing that we found too, is mm-hmm. like, you know, as much as you'd like to think this issue is affects a very specific population or something, we're all just kind of a stone's throw away from facing that reality. Did anything else surprise you while you were reporting?
I don't know if this was surprising, but it's something that's always important to note. And that's that, like, the population we were talking with wasn't a monolith. So there were people who across the political spectrum and who believed different things about the way this issue should be solved. And a lot of times it's easy to assume, I think, that people in the same situation have the same ideas about how it should be solved. And that's just not true. So that was something that was really driven home for me as I was talking to people who are food insecure.
Yeah. And for me, this also isn't really a surprise, but it's something we don't think about as much, I think, is that a lot of the experts I talked to told me kind of about how food insecurity isn't kind of like the problem in itself. It's a symptom of other like overarching systems and hierarchies and disadvantages in these systems that, you know, leave people in poverty. And that very rarely does that ever show up in just being food insecure. It's, you know, lack of access. It's lack of care from the outside, you know, community or society. It's kind of not having, you know, that support system that you mentioned. And so it's like all these little factors that kind of weave into this web that leaves people really at that disadvantage.
Yeah, totally. And like salaries. And it's, yeah. It's like a microcosm of like a broader systemic issue.
Definitely.
Yeah. You know, you touched on the first question. You guys touched on how food insecurity disproportionately impacts certain groups, particularly the elderly and children, among like other sort of vulnerable populations. So after talking with your sources and doing all the interviews that you guys did, would you just touch on the inequities surrounding food insecurity? I know you did a little bit earlier, but I just kind of want to hit it on the nose about just sort of the, you know, the inequities around this issue.
It's easy to think that everybody thinks of it in the same way, but you have to really think about the intersectionality within this. So like, for example, when we were speaking with seniors and talking with experts who worked, you know, specifically in poverty and addressing food insecurity for seniors, they talked a lot about, you know, disability and the prevalence of that and, you know, the lack of caregivers. Like one interesting thing that I still think about is, you know, a senior who is experiencing food insecurity or experiencing poverty, whatever that looks like for them, they might have access to things like food pantries in their community or to a grocery store. So it's not really a food access issue all the time, as much as it is, you know, actually getting there, things like transportation, healthcare. So it really is like you need to have that support system. You know, none of this is going to be fixed by just policy or like changes at the state level. It has to be, you know, family members and friends and people in your community willing to show up for you. And not everybody has that, unfortunately.
No, without a doubt.
And like you said, I mean, food insecurity, it's not the same. It's not synonymous with food deserts, right. But it is such a huge part of that problem, particularly like we're reporting from southern Indiana. So a lot of these people are from rural communities, and that access does become something that compounds the already existing issue, which is, you know, the lack of enough funds to be able to pay for it or, you know, whatever else you might have.
Absolutely. And that's a good jumping off point into rural communities. So there's also disparity between urban and rural Hoosiers. Now, it's not just specific to Indiana, but our focus was kind of, you know, zoomed in on this community when it comes to food insecurity. How did you see this play out in your reporting?
Well, I can tell you from a source that I talked with, she chose to be anonymous, so we called her Jessica in the story. But she was in a rural area, and something that you don't even think about is just how much it costs for gas. Getting, you know, she's dropping off her kids at school and she's taking them out of district because she wants them to have, you know, a better opportunity, a school with better resources. And then she's also driving to work, and her husband needs the car because he's delivering pizzas. And all of that is taking away from their budget for the month. And that's a problem that they would not have in maybe a different community with better supermarkets that are closer to where she's located, with closer schools and all of that. So that was just one major disparity I saw in rural areas based on my reporting.
Yeah, it's just a testament to the extra layer of things that impact rural folks.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest things that stands out to me is kind of like, I touched on this earlier, but like the prevalence of food pantries and that community support. Like here in Bloomington, we have, you know, we have Hoosier Hills Food Bank. IU has Crimson Cupboard. Like there are so many resources here. And this problem still exists. So, you know, we think about out in rural areas with maybe a 2,000 person population, it's not always going to be the same.
That was an interview with Christina Avery and Haley Miller, two reporters from the Limestone Post magazine who authored a two-part series on food insecurity. Visit WFHB.org to read the full articles and listen to the accompanying radio segments on food insecurity for Deep Dive, WFHB and Limestone Post Investigate.
Up next, Eclipse Heads Up on Better Beware, your weekly consumer watchdog segment hosted and produced by Richard Fish. Fish has more.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
You probably already know that it looks like it's going to be a really big deal. Next Monday, there's going to be a total solar eclipse, and the WFHB listening area is right in the path of this phenomenon. Bloomington is actually smack dead center of the line of totality. Police and local officials are warning that 300,000 people may come here to see the event. The total population of Monroe County is around 140,000, so we can expect it to suddenly triple or more. Wow! Driving on the roads is going to be nothing like it usually is, and the traffic jams will be at their worst after the eclipse is over. The moon will start moving across the sun at 1:49 p.m. Totality will happen at 3:06 p.m. and last about 4 minutes, and the sun will finally be shining clear again by 4:22 p.m. That's when thousands of cars will hit the road trying to go somewhere else all at once. It may take a couple of days for things to settle down, but they'll be coming in for a day or three ahead of time. You know what happens when students return and the city is suddenly full of people who don't know where they're going, aren't familiar with the one-way streets, and some drivers who've never seen a four-way stop. This could be about 10 times worse. You don't want to have to run out to the store, look for a parking place, or try to put gas in your car during this period. So fill up and stock up now. And you do want to stay safe. Most importantly, you can't look at a solar eclipse without special glasses that will block the most intense and harmful solar rays. You can get such glasses in many places, City Hall for one, and many local merchants have them. Regular sunglasses, smoked glass, and polarized lenses are not safe. You need something 1,000 times darker, like welder's goggles. But beware. There are counterfeit eclipse glasses going around that will not protect your eyes. Here's how to make sure you've got good ones. First, try them on inside. You shouldn't be able to see anything, even looking directly at a bright light. If you can see furniture or wall decorations, don't use them. Then, try them on outside. You shouldn't be able to see anything except maybe a reflection of sunlight as a very faint speck. If they seem good, you can try looking at the sun, but just for a second or two, and it should appear comfortably bright and maybe yellow, orange, or bluish. Plan ahead. Prepare now. Try to stay off the roads. Make sure you have everything you might need, and stay safe. I'll be back next week, after the sun is back for good. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
Up next, we rebroadcast an excerpt from our deep dive series on Indiana's education policy. To find all previous deep dive episodes, you can visit wfhb.org or limestonepostmagazine.com.
During the 2023 legislative session, the Indiana State House passed a swath of bills that advocates are calling a slate of hate. According to the American Civil Liberties Union of Indiana, this year, Indiana lawmakers introduced a record number of bills targeting LGBTQ+ Hoosiers. This included a Don't Say Gay bill that forces teachers to out students, a banning of essential medical care for trans youth, and a bill that censors books in schools related to LGBTQ+ topics, all of which were signed into law.
Today, WFHB News focuses on House-enrolled Act 1608, titled Education Matters. This law prohibits any person, entity, or vendor working in school from providing instruction on human sexuality for grades K through 8. It also requires schools to notify parents or guardians in writing when their child requests to change their name, title, pronouns, or other identifying terms if the student is not an emancipated minor.
We spoke with the executive director of the ACLU, Jane Henniger, about the litigation the ACLU has filed against the state of Indiana for the slate of hate.
So all of our litigation against these laws and all kinds of laws represent real people who've been directly impacted by the laws. So the legislation that would prevent teachers in K through 3 classrooms talking about human sexuality would represent a real-life teacher who is concerned about how that would impact her teaching and her ability to figure out, can I read and Tango Makes Three to my class? without getting in trouble and those kinds of questions. How do I respond to questions from kids? Can I, you know, do I have to be constantly worried about what I say and how I say it beyond, you know, just the general care that teachers take when they're interacting with their students?
Students spoke out against HEA 1608 during a school board meeting of the Monroe County Community School Corporation in August. A high school senior who asked to be identified as Possum took to the public mic to voice their concerns about the statewide policy.
And today I'm going by the name Possum. The day before the first day of school, I caught wind of HB 1608. At first I wondered if I should comply maliciously by changing my name every day, but immediately after having that thought, I realized the extra load that it would put on my teachers. I talked to others about it, and I realized the school board should be the ones fighting for us students. I shouldn't have to fight for the right to my name, nor should my teachers have to. By resisting this law, you not only have the chance to influence schools, you have the chance to influence the attitudes of youth in the greater community.
In an interview with WFHB News, Dr. Jeff Hoswald, superintendent for MCCSE, described his initial reaction to House-enrolled Act 1608 when it passed.
Individually, I had grave concerns for the legislation, and I think that we voiced those. I know that we voiced them. Also, MCCSE is an organization. We actively engaged with our legislators and really were opposed to any bill that we believe has the direct or indirect effect of discriminating against our students.
Beth Clausen, the mother of a 10-year-old transgender daughter, lobbied without success against the gender-affirming care ban that was passed this year. Clausen said that this legislation took an emotional toll on her family.
I mean, it's something that we wanted to do and we felt that we had to do. It's the second year that we have spoke. We also spoke last year against the sports bill, the ban on trans girls in sports. So we knew what we were getting into. This year was very intense. You know, it took us away from our jobs. We had to rely on other people to help us, like, get our kids to school and get them ready so that we could be there to testify. And it was an emotional toll.
Clausen commented on HEA 1608, saying that she worries this policy risks students being outed to their parents, even if their parents don't support their identity.
I worry my teenage children have friends who are trans, and they have families that are not, who are not accepting. And I really worry, and the only place those kids can be themselves is at school, and that's getting taken away from them.
Support for WFHB Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. More information online at mpisolarenergy.com. You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Elise Perry, Kelsey Peace, and Noel Herhusky-Schneider in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Cade Young and Noel Herhusky-Schneider.
Better Beware is produced by Richard Fish. Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. For WFHB, I'm Cade Young.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast online at WFHB.org.
The WFHB Local News is also available as a podcast. Just search our call letters, WFHB, wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribe to never miss another local news program.
Stay tuned for Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio, coming up next on WFHB.